listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's this month's cover story, All About Anna, by Sloane Crosley. With a Bond reinvention and a Marilyn reimagining on the horizon, the breakout star of Knives Out is poised to take Hollywood. But Ana de Armas dreams of Cuba even as she's ruling California. Photographs for this article by Cass Bird, styled by Samira Nasser. Opening photo, Strong Bond, Ana de Armas, photographed in Beverly Hills, wearing a long white flowing dress by Valentino. There is a door that separates celebrities from civilians, leaving those of us curious enough to peer through the keyhole with an incomplete idea of fame. Here, for example, is the keyhole version of Ana de Armas, the 31-year-old breakout star of last year's Knives Out. She darts across the dining room of Versailles, the Culver City outpost of Miami's famed Cuban restaurant, like she's trying to shave a few seconds off her time. It's the day before the Golden Globes, and she has just come from a facial, which puts one in mind of a butler polishing already gleaming silverware. What is here for an esthetician to excavate, I do not know. De Armas has been nominated for her portrayal of Marta Cabrera, the moral compass of the whodunit ensemble, and while she will not win the award, she will win the red carpet in a navy sequined Ralph and Russo gown, a crystalline snow white with borderline anime eyes. As the lights flicker above us, she smiles and says, "Just like Cuba." Oh, but De Armas's light shows no signs of dimming. End of keyhole. It's impossible, right, to capture a whole person, to understand someone else's life without context. I don't see this moment, and I am in the middle of it. I don't think I'll ever be able to, and by the time I can, it will have changed. Freshly yet firmly on the other side of fame's door, De Armas is in the rare position to fling it open, to be frank about what it means to be in the spotlight, to have your life reduced to a stereotype, to be sick of Los Angeles. By the time you read this, she'll be gone. Just a few years ago, she was spending 7 hours a day sitting in a classroom, learning to speak English, which she did in 4 months. Now she's one of Hollywood's most efficient multitaskers. She's about to appear in No Time to Die, the 25th James Bond movie, in a role conceived for her by Cary Joji Fukunaga and written mostly by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She stars in the upcoming erotic thriller Deep Water with Ben Affleck, directed by Adrian Lyne, as well as in The Night Clerk with Helen Hunt, and in Netflix's political drama Sergio. She will be going back to her roots. She was a tow-headed child, to become Marilyn Monroe in Blonde. The fact that her earlier work alongside Ryan Gosling, Blade Runner 2049, and Keanu Reeves, Twice, Exposed, and Knock Knock, is already so far down her IMDb page is fairly astounding. So how did she get here? Beans, partly. "I am so excited for this food," she says, tearing apart a piece of bread you could wring butter out of, "which is crazy because I just came from 2 weeks in Cuba. This is my fuel." De Armas owns a home in Havana, where the majority of her friends and family still live. 2 minutes in her company invokes easy images of a dreamlike Havana. She spent New Year's at a roof party in the old part of Havana, playing music and dancing and drinking. But things are more complicated than they seem. That party was full of actors she's long admired, who said how proud they were, and that now I was the example for Cuban actors. She cries just recounting it. Her parents have never been able to attend one of her film premieres. They see her work later, like a bad copy or something. In what should be satire, some L.A. acquaintances have gone so far as to tell her they envy the digital detox of Cuba, or the fun of not knowing what you're going to eat for breakfast. When the country was briefly open during the Obama administration, she heard concerns it would be overrun by Starbucks. Americans complain about something existing, but then when they don't have it, they also complain. Consider her answer to, "What are you wearing?" which should be the celebrity equivalent of spelling your name correctly on the SATs. "I don't have any clothing." "Come again?" "I came straight from Havana, so I've been wearing my plain clothes. My suitcases go full of clothing or medicine or supplies, whatever people need, and come back empty. My stylist gave me this Saint Laurent suit so I'd look cool. I don't wear this in real life." For the record, she does have clothing. It's just all in New Orleans, where she's filming Deep Water. And, for the record, Hollywood is not my life, it's my reality. I have great friends, and incredible things have happened for me here, but the lifestyle and the exposure and the constant business situations are not for me. I like talking about life and art and babies and pets. Acting is what I love to do, but I can't talk about it. Not all the time. Or to quote Marilyn Monroe, "It's good to have caviar, but not when you have it at every meal. Beans, maybe, but not caviar." Thus, De Armas is moving back to Havana for now, half an hour from the beach town where she grew up. As a kid, she didn't sneak into the city, because it's a big deal to go when you don't have transportation. Instead, she and her friends entertained themselves and the neighbors by acting, dancing, and singing. She was Baby Spice, in an adorably amateur Spice Girls cover band, but didn't understand the lyrics to Wannabe until she heard it on the radio a few years ago. Eventually, her parents enrolled her in theater school. "I would hitchhike every single morning, just stand next to the stoplight, where the cars have to go anyway, go to the window, and tell people where I needed to go." But American films weren't a glimmer in her eye, mostly because she couldn't see herself in them. "I would see the houses and airplanes and all the money and people robbing banks, and it clearly wasn't real, just the way princesses weren't real. It was fantasy. The Cuban actors were the ones I was looking at, because that was my reality. People getting in a boat, or screaming at one another, or killing a pig." De Armas left for Madrid at 18, as soon as she legally could, only able to because her maternal grandparents are Spanish. There, things fell into place quickly. She got an agent through a movie she'd made 2 years prior, and then got lucky, and a week later, a casting director called. De Armas starred in El Internado, the boarding school, which was a massive hit, a little like Stranger Things. Only after she felt like she'd outgrown it, both creatively, she felt uninspired, and practically, she was still playing a teenager, did she come to the States. I find it difficult to imagine that Hollywood wasn't the endgame, given how well she's taken to it, and it to her. As Bobby Finger put it about De Armas on the Who Weekly podcast, It's funny, when someone's like, this talented woman is about to be everywhere, and then you look at them and you're like, yeah, no shit. But as De Armas reminds me, context is key. Hers was one of the few Cuban families with no one in Miami even. The conversation was always Spain. People ask, how did you make this choice or that? But there was only ever one choice at a time. I've never seen my life in two ways, the way I wanted it and plan B. There was only ever the way I wanted it. One gets the sense there's not a lot out of De Armas' reach. Her Knives Out co-star Jamie Lee Curtis had no idea who she was when they met. In a scene straight out of Notting Hill, she says she thought Anna was this piece of unmolded clay, and I ask her about her goals, like I'm talking to a college student. And then I emailed Steven effing Spielberg, saying his casting department should really look into this woman, as if she didn't even have an agent. A year later, Curtis is in a better position to assess her friend's determination. She is remarkable. She's going to be like Sophia Loren, one of those rare crossover worldwide sensations. She's got this exquisite depth and is singularly gentle and insanely beautiful. But also, she is a girl from Cuba, so there's that tenacity and perseverance and fierceness to her. Such depth of characterization was absent from the initial description of De Armas' Knives Out character. Marta was boiled down to Latina caretaker, pretty, and De Armas almost didn't take the part. She points out that Latina actors are still frequently pigeonholed, using words like sensuality and fire. Or else it's sexy with a temper, and it's who we are. There's nothing wrong with it, so long as it's not only that. That's what I have a problem with. You mean you don't wake up every morning, put on a short skirt, and start screaming at people? Oh, well, yeah, I do that until I get exhausted, and then I put a basket of fruit on my head and say, go F yourself, and then I take a break and do it again. As much as she avoids stereotyping in her work, she thinks that it has, on occasion, been useful behind the scenes, particularly in a pre-hashtag Me Too Hollywood. She credits her parents for teaching her about men and boundaries and how to speak out, and describes herself as quick and capable and I don't give a shit. And while she considers herself lucky to have worked with gracious and proper human beings, she admits that the Cuban thing helps. How so? She narrows her eyes, waves her finger, and makes a tisk-tisk noise like she's watching a dog contemplate bad behavior. When De Armas arrived in L.A., she demanded her agents send her out to auditions, telling them she didn't come to Hollywood to get a degree in English. If there's a story already associated with De Armas, it's this one. She did it all, phonetically, on the set of War Dogs, in which she plays Miles Teller's girlfriend. Director Todd Phillips changed a line of dialogue, and it was a disaster. In the end, he was like, okay, forget it. Just say what you had. It's not a good place to be as an actor. I couldn't sustain a conversation. The first time I read for a part, I had no clue what I beg your pardon was, she remembers, laughing. I thought it was really angry, like I beg your pardon. Like, I'm going to take your pardon. And every person in the room was like, she has no clue what she's saying right now. But the thing is, I knew exactly what was happening in the scene. It was a crazy combination of she has no clue and she's doing it. Like all actors, fresh and seasoned alike, De Armas has nothing but diplomatic adjectives for her projects and co-stars. But she absolutely beams when she talks about Blonde, adapted from Joyce Carol Oates' Pulitzer-nominated fictionalization of Norma Jean Baker and directed by Andrew Dominik. I only had to audition for Marilyn once, and Andrew said, it's you. But I had to audition for everyone else, the producers, the money people. I always have people I needed to convince. But I knew I could do it. Playing Marilyn was groundbreaking. A Cuban playing Marilyn Monroe. I wanted it so badly. Before the script came her way, her knowledge of Monroe was limited to a few iconic roles and photos, but now she's become a human conveyor belt of fun facts. Even her dog, Elvis, plays Monroe's dog in the film. His name was Mafia. Sinatra gave him to her, of course. She also identifies with Monroe in a more profound way. You see that famous photo of her? And she is smiling in the moment, but that's just a slice of what she was really going through at the time. I have never worked more closely with a director than I worked with Andrew. Yes, I have had collaborative relationships, but to get phone calls at midnight because he has an idea and he can't sleep, and all of a sudden you can't sleep for the same reason. I remember when she showed me a video of her screen test for Blonde, says Curtis, whose father starred with Monroe in Some Like It Hot. I dropped to the floor. I couldn't believe it. Anna was completely gone. She was Marilyn. After months of immersive prep work, it seemed like nothing could tear her away from her Marilyn love affair. But who among us has not had our head turned by James Bond? No Time to Die director Cary Joji Fukunaga, who's been a fan of De Armas for years, wrote the role of Paloma specifically for Anna, adding a layer of humor to the character that I hadn't seen her do yet, which I thought might be fun. He, too, is quick to offer adjectives accounting for De Armas' appeal, confidence, humor, a can-do attitude, but at the end of the day, it's intangible. People either have that magic quality you want to watch, or they don't. She has it. If you could quantify it, you could probably sell it. Despite the tailor-made invitation to 007's world, De Armas wanted to be sure she was not doing Bond for Bond's sake. Obviously, I was jumping all over the place and very excited, but I needed to be sure it wouldn't jeopardize all the work I'd been putting in, that it wouldn't ruin everything. And the Bond women have always been, for me at least, unrelatable. Her concerns were valid. In addition to rumors of writer musical chairs and on-set mishaps, as The Independent put it, has there been a more fraught Bond production than No Time to Die? This is the first Bond film of the Time's Up era. Yet it's not the first time the franchise has attempted to address sexism. Historically, this effort comes in the form of giving Bond girls nonsensically rarefied degrees and character names that exist to support a single pun. See also, I thought Christmas only comes once a year. Zing! Bond girl can be as reductive as Latina caretaker pretty. I don't even call them Bond girls, says Daniel Craig. I'm not going to deny it to anybody else. It's just I can't have a sensible conversation with somebody if we're talking about Bond girls. Craig was first struck by Anna's performance in Blade Runner 2049. So his reaction to her being cast alongside him in Knives Out and No Time to Die was similarly enthusiastic. I should always be so lucky to work with a woman like that. This is a movie where there's a lot of shit going on, a lot of big acting. Myself, very much included, but she shines through because she's the real deal. She's got very good comic timing, and we're not offering her a huge part. But she came in and just nailed it. She had very little to go on. The scripts are being rewritten, you're changing things all the time or throwing them at her, and she's not fazed by it. Looks like someone doesn't have to beg anyone's pardon anymore. Zing. You could also tell that Phoebe was in there, says De Armas. There was that humor and spikiness so specific to her. My character feels like a real woman. But, you know, we can evolve and grow and incorporate reality. But Bond is a fantasy. In the end, you can't take things out of where they live. There wasn't any other choice, explains longtime Bond producer Barbara Broccoli, sounding as laser-visioned as DeArmas herself. It was Anna we all wanted. Between Barbara and her father, the legendary Cubby Broccoli, they have produced 25 Bond films. Her hold music is Shirley Bassey's Diamonds Are Forever. Her character is someone who's just started working for the CIA, and so she's supposed to have minimal training when she first meets Bond. The expectation is that she's not going to be the most proficient agent, but let's just say that she really packs a punch. As refreshing as DeArmas is, it would be a mistake to think of her as a babe in these tinsel-strung woods. This is an assumption she herself goes back and forth on, sometimes hitting the gas of savvy movie star, and sometimes the brakes of vulnerability. I'm like a fish out of water. The big-picture version of her is less like her Knives Out character in her first scene, and more like her in the movie's last shot. The kind-hearted woman who got drawn into a game she didn't necessarily want to play, but still won. When the lights flicker again in the restaurant, and waiters sing Feliz Cumpleaños, a tea, to a neighboring table, she decides, ah, so not just like Cuba, too bad. She means for this interview in the same way that when she gamely suggests we get a drink, she orders a daiquiri, because a mojito is too Hemingway, too obvious. When she first got to L.A., she met producer Colleen Camp while with her agent in the CAA parking garage. Camp then introduced her to Broccoli, which led her to No Time to Die. It's true that DeArmas' success, equal parts artistry and necessity, has been achieved through the kind of determination few in her position have come by so honestly. People ask, how did you learn English so quickly? I'm like, because my life depended on it. But can it also be true that she is not alone, that the industry machinery has been trying to position her as the next Penelope Cruz since War Dogs? Can't it also be true that she's actually quite entrenched in Caviar Town, USA? She was a pre-implosion Weinstein Company starlet, starring in 2016's Hands of Stone. Early in her L.A. life, she was in a serious relationship with agent Franklin Latt, heir apparent to Kevin Huvane at CAA. As her name recognition has spread, she's become no stranger to paparazzi or dating gossip. The fundamentals of American visibility. Perhaps so close to the other side of fame's door, such realities can seem like potential liabilities to discuss. We don't get into names, but about her personal life, she says succinctly, I've had company here, but it's been the wrong company, so I prefer to be alone. For anyone who ever questions, or how did I get to do this or that, F them. They will not get to spend their New Year's with me. They are not the people whose opinion I should care about. They are not the people I share my happiness with. I've never had an agenda. All I want to do is work. All I want to do is get something challenging and prove to myself that I can do it. We are both full of beans and rum. Outside, the sky has turned orange. Perhaps a more worthy backdrop for a rooftop in Havana than the middle of Venice Boulevard. The restaurant lights flicker for a fourth time, and we silently agree that we are all Feliz Cumpleaños out. No matter what happens at the awards tomorrow night, DeArmas knows she will remember it as one wonderful evening during this moment in time, that night, that will keep changing. As we head for the door, she flings a suede leopard print YSL bag over her shoulder. I stop her. Wow, your stylist really did hook you up. No, no, she smiles. This one's mine. I tell her I'd be worried I'd destroy it. Oh, you can't be, she says, going back out the way she came in. Life is for living. All That Jazz by Rachel Syme. Interviews by Britt Hinemuth. The Roaring Twenties are officially upon us, bringing with them heady abandon. This season's rising stars show off opulence with a modern twist. Photographs by Daniel Jackson. Styled by Samira Nasser. Opening photo, Sophia Lillis. Scene in Gretel and Hansel and It, Chapter 2. Up next, I Am Not Okay With This, on Netflix this month. Dream Closet, Hannah Montana's rotating walk-in closet. Favorite destination, Ireland. Greatest indulgence, sleep. In the fall of 1931, F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife, Zelda, returned to the United States after spending much of the 20s abroad. They found the country much changed. Having left the champagne-soaked festivities early, by the time they returned, all that was left was an empty dance hall with glitter on the floor. They'd been so busy careering around Europe in a dizzying cloud of cocksure charisma and personal drama that they didn't notice the moment things began to unravel. After the stock market plummeted in 1929, the Fitzgeralds were on holiday in North Africa. As Fitzgerald later wrote, "We heard a dull, distant crash, which echoed to the farthest waste of the desert." But they kept drinking, seeing no need to sail home. The crash echoed through their lives nonetheless. That year, Zelda's mental health declined, and she checked into the Swiss clinic Les Rives de Printemps, where she scribbled letters about spending her days writing soggy words in the rain and feeling dank inside. Fitzgerald, for his part, was unable to finish his next novel. When they finally arrived home on a steamer, Fitzgerald wrote, they found that several of their most buoyant friends had also begun to sink. Somebody had blundered, he wrote in an essay that year, and the most expensive orgy in history was over. It is never easy to pinpoint the exact moment that a party begins to wind down. But as Fitzgerald noted, looking back on the Jazz Age, the party is usually over before anyone notices. It is ending all the time, from the moment someone kicks off their first heel. Decadence, that state of ecstatic, almost sublime decay, is really just opulence with an expiration date. Fitzgerald wrote that friends were living far beyond their means, and they knew it, and they simply didn't care. Even when you were broke, you didn't worry about money, because it was in such profusion around you, he wrote. Now, once more, the belt is tight, and we summon the proper expression of horror as we look back at our wasted youth. We are living in the 20s again, but our times are not roaring, at least not with giddy, boozy elation. Who can afford the performative nihilism of doing the foxtrot into oblivion? Wasted youth is a privilege, one that so many young people today cannot access. The planet is crumbling. Right-wing extremism is on the rise. Wealth disparity is worse than it has been in a century. This we do have in common with Fitzgerald's time. The party is very much over. Or at least the record player is snagging, and people have started to grab their coats. The biggest drinking trend among people under 30 these days is sobriety. If fashion is flirting with decadence, the recent runway shows glittered with grandiosity and razzle-dazzle, then at least this decadence is gimlet-eyed and somewhat sobering. There is a kind of weaking meta-maximalism happening at the moment, a luxury that knows itself and its own limitations, knows how precarious it all is. Fashion is having riotous fun, but it is not blithe or indulgent. This is sartorial raging against a dying light. This is eating a chocolate cake at 2 a.m, because who can say when the sun will rise? In entertainment, we are in a clear period of heady excess. The streaming revolution has led to an explosion of new stories with monumental production values and opportunities for fresh faces seeking stardom. This may be a scary time to be a person, but it is an excellent time to be in Hollywood. There has never been a more diverse, textured, exciting array of projects and talent, with real money and energy fueling their development. How long can it last? No one can say, but for now we should revel in it, and in the thrilling crop of newcomers that have bubbled up in this new era. So what if the party's dwindling? Let's dance. And so here is a portfolio reveling in willful decadence, about the velvet and brocade and baubles that you put on, not as a distraction from the world, but in celebration of your potential within it and in spite of it. These are not times to retreat into Spartan asceticism. These are days for sparkle, for ruffles, for amulets and waistcoats. Fashion should feel a little bit gaudy, a little bit unstable, perhaps incautious and maybe even fleeting. Nothing is permanent. No decade roars forever. The new twenties are about not ignoring the dull, distant crashes, but facing them head on in a party dress. In the photos, Kelvin Harrison Jr., seen in The Photograph and Waves. Up next, The Trial of the Chicago Seven in October. Dream Closet, ASAP Rocky's. Favorite Destination, Budapest. Greatest Indulgence, Chocolate Lava Cake. Prized Possession, His Grandfather's Necklace. Jamila Jamil, seen in The Good Place on NBC. Up next, Legendary on HBO Max. Fantasy Closet, Diane Keaton by day, Sophia Loren by night. Favorite Place, Rome. They allow people to age with dignity. Greatest Indulgence, microwaved sourdough with butter. Prized Possession, I value my relationship more than money, success, and sourdough. Diana Silvers, seen in Booksmart and Ma. Up next, Space Force on Netflix. Fantasy Closet, Twiggy's. Favorite Place, Montana, but she'd like to move to London. Greatest Indulgence, mac and cheese. Prized Possession, her record collection. Mia Goth, seen in Suspiria. Stars in Emma in theaters now. Fantasy Closet, Jane Birkins. Favorite Place, Brazil. Greatest Indulgence, pasta. If I'm sad, if I'm happy, if it's Sunday, I am eating pasta. Prized Possession, my apartment. I relish it. Glenn Powell, seen in Set It Up and Hidden Figures. Up next, Top Gun, Maverick, in June. Fantasy Closet, Butch Cassidy's or the Sundance Kid's. Greatest Indulgence, barbecue. Prized Possession, a gift from Mr. Cruise himself. An IWC Top Gun Fighter Weapons School watch inscribed, Your Friend, Tom Mav. Jessica Henwick, seen in Underwater. Up next, Sofia Coppola's On the Rocks, Godzilla vs. Kong in November, and The Matrix 4 next year. Fantasy Closet, Faye Wong's. Favorite Place, the Camino de Santiago Trail in Spain. Greatest Indulgence, I'm a really easy person to buy a gift for because you can just give me a massage. Prized Possession, my brain. Charles Melton, seen in Bad Boys for Life. Stars in Riverdale on the CW. Fantasy Closet, Elvis Presley's. Favorite Place, Big Pine, California. Greatest Indulgence, massages. Prized Possession, my chucks. Amanda Stenberg, seen in The Hate U Give. Up next, Damien Chazelle's The Eddie on Netflix. Fantasy Closet, I love shoes. I'd fill it with Dickies and Louis Vuitton flats. Favorite Place, Paris. Greatest Indulgence, love. Prized Possession, my cat, Kumo. He's a tabby with giant green eyes. And David Corenswet, seen in The Politician on Netflix. Up next, another Ryan Murphy Netflix series, Hollywood, in May. Fantasy Closet, Humphrey Bogart's. Favorite Place, Los Angeles. Greatest Indulgence, Flying Lessons. Prized Possession, the New York subway token that my dad kept as his good luck charm when he was an actor. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Tom Ford, the designer and director on Parenthood, Aging, and Reluctant Schmoozing. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Life with no Instagram and no selfies. I am so tired of looking at people staring out of the window of a private plane with a small dog in their laps. What is your greatest fear? Couples who have to be sat side by side at LA dinner parties. What is that all about? Which living person do you most admire? Gloria Steinem. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Perfectionism. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Narcissism. What is your greatest extravagance? Sleep and donuts. What is your favorite journey? The one to my bed every night. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Political correctness. On what occasion do you lie? It's hard to get through a large cocktail party without lying dozens of times. You look amazing. Oh my God, it's so great to see you. We need to see each other more, when really I am dying to get home and watch Netflix. What do you dislike most about your appearance? The fact that my butt seems to be sliding down my thighs. Which living person do you most despise? Well, we all know who, but I don't want to give him any more airtime. What is your greatest regret? That I never slept with Cary Grant. What or who was the greatest love of your life? Our son, Jack. When and where are you happiest? Staring at our son every night when he is sleeping. Which talent would you most like to have? The ability to relax. What is your current state of mind? Cluttered. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? My terrible temper. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Being a good parent, or at least trying to be. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, and could choose what to come back as, what would it be? The Barcelona Pavilion. What is your most treasured possession? My ability to simply say, F it. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Have you ever taken a mirror and bent over and looked at what happens to your face? If you are over 35, it is not pretty. I've definitely entered the age of only lying on my back when in intimate situations. What is your favorite occupation? Making films. What is your most marked characteristic? Loyalty. What do you most value in your friends? A sense of humor. Who are your heroes in life? Doctors. What are your favorite names? Classic ones. Names have become so absurd, especially in LA. If I meet one more person named after a tree, a fruit, or an obscure spice, I'm going to lose it. What is it that you most dislike? People who cancel dates at the last minute. LA seems to be filled with these people. How would you like to die? Alone. What is your motto? Listen to everyone, and then do what you want. Actually, I've lifted that quote from Diane von Furstenberg, but it's genius. I live by it. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Tom Ford. Thank you. Vanity Fair, Hollywood Calling, open through July 26th. Vanity Fair, Hollywood Calling features photographic portraiture and multimedia installations that capture the magic and glamour of the film and television industry's major players from the last four decades. The exhibition is a look at the Hollywood stars, the parties, and the power brokers through the distinctive lens of Vanity Fair, the most widely celebrated journalistic arbiter of Hollywood power and personality. The new exhibition at Annenberg Space for Photography, 2000 Avenue of the Stars, Los Angeles. Admission always free. Pictured here, Lupita Nyong'o, photographed by Jackie Nickerson, from Vanity Fair, October 2019. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming live via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.